Muhammad, Disc 2.
Muhammad was also seeking a new solution. For some years, accompanied by Khadija, he had made an annual retreat on Mount Hira during the month of Ramadan, distributing alms to the poor who visited him in his mountain cave and performing devotions. We know very little about these practices, which were believed by some of the sources to have been inaugurated by Muhammad's grandfather. They seem to have combined social concern with rituals that may have included deep prostrations before Allah and intensive circumambulation of the Kaaba. At this time, Muhammad had also started to have numinous dreams, radiant with hope and promise, that burst upon him like the dawn of the morning, a phrase that in Arabic expresses the sudden transformation of the world when the sun breaks through the darkness in these eastern lands where there is no twilight. It was while he was making his annual retreat on Mount Hira in about the year 610 that he experienced the astonishing and dramatic attack. The words that were squeezed as if from the depths of his being went to the root of the problem in Mecca. Recite in the name of your Lord who created, from an embryo created the human. Recite, your Lord is all-giving, who taught by the pen, taught the human what he did not know before. The human being is a tyrant. He thinks his possessions make him secure. To your Lord is the return of everything. This verse was an extension of the Quraysh's belief that Allah had created each one of them. It identified the proud self-sufficiency of the tribal ideal as a delusion, because humans are entirely dependent upon God. Finally, Allah insisted that he was not a distant, absent deity, but wanted to instruct and guide his creatures so they must come near to him. But instead of approaching God in a spirit of prideful self-sufficiency, they must bow before him like a lowly slave. Touch your head to the earth, God commanded, a posture that would be repugnant to the haughty Quraysh. From the very beginning, Muhammad's religion was diametrically opposed to some of the essential principles of the old tribal ideal. When Muhammad came to himself, he was so horrified to think that after all his spiritual striving, he had simply been visited by a jinni, that he no longer wanted to live. In despair, he fled from the cave and started to climb to the summit of the mountain to fling himself to his death. But there he had another vision. He saw a mighty being that filled the horizon and stood gazing at him, moving neither forward nor backward. He tried to turn away, but, he said afterwards, towards whatever region of the sky I looked, I saw him as before. It was the spirit of revelation, which Muhammad would later call Gabriel. But this was no pretty, naturalistic angel, but a transcendent presence that defied ordinary human and spatial categories. And still unable to comprehend what had happened, Muhammad stumbled down the mountainside to Khadija. By the time he reached her, he was crawling on his hands and knees, shaking convulsively. "Cover me," he cried, as he flung himself into her lap. Khadija wrapped him in a cloak and held him in her arms until his fear abated. She had no doubts at all about the revelation. "This was no jinni," she insisted. "God would never play such a cruel trick on a man who had honestly tried to serve him." "You are kind and considerate to your kin," she reminded him. "You help the poor and forlorn and bear their burdens. You're striving to restore the high moral qualities that your people have lost. You honour the guest and go to the assistance of those in distress. This cannot be, my dear. Muhammad and Khadija had probably discussed their dawning understanding of the true nature of a religion that went beyond ritual performance and required practical compassion and sustained moral effort. To reassure Muhammad, Khadija consulted her cousin Waraka, the Hanif, who had studied the scriptures of the people of the book and could give them expert advice. Waraka was jubilant. "Holy, holy," he cried when he heard what had happened. "If you have spoken the truth to me, O Khadija, there has come to him the great divinity who came to Moses aforetime, and lo, he is the prophet of his people." The next time Waraka met Muhammad in the Haram, he kissed him on the forehead and warned him that his task would not be easy. Waraka was an old man and not likely to live much longer, but he wished he could be alive to help Muhammad when the Quraysh expelled him from the city. Muhammad was dismayed. He could not conceive of a life outside Mecca. "Would they really cast him out?" he asked in dismay. Waraka sadly told him that a prophet was always without honour in his own country. It was a difficult beginning, fraught with fear, anxiety, and the threat of persecution. Yet the Quran has preserved another account of the experience on Mount Hira, in which the descent of the spirit is described as an event of wonder, gentleness, and peace, similar to the conception of Jesus in the womb of Mary. "We sent him down on the night of destiny. And what can tell you of the night of destiny? The night of destiny is better than 1,000 months. The angels come down, the spirit upon her, by permission of their Lord from every order. Peace she is until the rise of dawn."
In this surah, or chapter of the Quran, there is a suggestive blurring of masculine and feminine, especially in pronouns, which is often lost in translation. In the Quran, the question, "What can tell you?" regularly introduces an idea that would have been strange to Muhammad's first audience, indicating that they were about to enter the realm of the ineffable. Here, Muhammad has self-effacingly disappeared from the drama of Mount Hira. And the night, Layla, is centre stage, like a woman waiting for her lover. The night of destiny had inaugurated a new era of communion between heaven and earth. The original terror of the divine encounter has been replaced by the peace that filled the darkness as the world waited for daybreak. Muhammad would have understood the German historian Rudolf Otto, who described the sacred as a mystery that was both tremendum and fascinans. It was overpowering, urgent, and terrible, but it also filled human beings with delight, joy, and a sense of swelling harmony and intimate intercourse. Revelation cannot be described in a simple manner, and the complexity of his experience made Muhammad very cautious of telling anybody about it. After the experience on Mount Hira, there were more visions. We do not know exactly how many. And then, to Muhammad's dismay, the divine voice fell silent, and there were no further revelations. It was a time of great desolation. Had Muhammad been deluded after all? Was the presence simply a mischievous jinni? Or had God found him wanting and abandoned him? For 2 long years, the heavens remained obdurately closed. And then, suddenly, the darkness was dispersed in a burst of luminous assurance. By the morning hours, by the night when it is still, Your Lord has not abandoned you and does not hate you. What is after will be better than what came before. To you the Lord will be giving. You will be content. Did he not find you orphaned and give you shelter? Find you lost and guide you? Find you in hunger and provide for you? As for the orphan, do not oppress him. And one who asks for help, do not turn him away. And the grace of your Lord proclaim.
Here Allah offered his assurance that he did not abandon his creatures and reminded men and women to imitate his continuous kindness and generosity. Human beings who had experienced the care of God had a duty to help the orphan and the deprived. Anybody who had known dereliction, hunger, and oppression must refuse under any circumstances to inflict this pain on others. The revelation concluded by telling Muhammad that it was time to proclaim this message to the Quraysh. But how would they respond?
Chapter 2. Jahiliyyah.
He began quietly, speaking about his revelations to a small band of friends and family members who became enthusiastic and sympathetic disciples, convinced that he was the long-awaited Arab prophet. But Muhammad realized that most of the Quraysh would find it well nigh impossible to accept this. The messengers of Allah had all been towering figures, founding fathers of society. Some had even worked miracles. How could Muhammad measure up to Moses or Jesus? The Quraysh had watched him growing up. They saw him going about his business in the market, eating and drinking like everybody else. They had jettisoned many old tribal values, but had retained its elitist aristocratic outlook and would expect God to choose a well-born hero from one of the more distinguished clans rather than a minor member of Hashim. How would they react when Muhammad told them to abandon their lofty independence in a way that violated the sunnah, the way of life, of their forefathers? Even at this early stage, Muhammad had encountered opposition. Khadija, their daughters, Ali and Zayd, accepted his new status unconditionally. But though his uncle, Abu Talib, would continue to love and support him, he was deeply pained that Muhammad had the temerity to depart from the absolute authority of their ancestors. He was splitting up the family. Muhammad's cousins, Ja'far, the son of Abu Talib, Abdullah and Ubaidullah ibn Jash, and their sister Zainab, all accepted the revelations. But his uncles, Abbas and Hamza, did not, though their wives did. Muhammad's son-in-law, Abu al-As, who had married his daughter Zainab, refused even to consider the new religion. Naturally, this was distressing to Muhammad. Family solidarity was a sacred value, and like any Arab, he respected the elders of his tribe and clan. He expected leadership to come from the top, but it was the younger generation who responded to his message. The revelations had already started to push Muhammad away from the norm. He could not help noticing that many of his followers came from the lower classes. A significant number were women, others freedmen, servants and slaves. Foremost among the slaves was Bilal, an Abyssinian with an extraordinarily loud voice. When the Muslims gathered to pray together in the Haram, Muhammad found himself surrounded by the young men and weak people of the city. Muhammad welcomed them warmly into his little company, but he must have wondered how a movement of such peripheral people could succeed. Indeed, some of the Quraysh elders, who as yet knew nothing of the revelations, had begun to ask him why he was consorting with such riffraff.
People were not all down and outs. This technical tribal term
denoted inferior tribal status rather than poverty. Muhammad's most zealous follower at this point was his friend, Atiq ibn Uthman, who was usually known by his kunya, Abu Bakr. After the birth of their first son, Arabs customarily take an honorary title known as the kunya. Abu Bakr means the father of Bakr. His wife would have been known as Bakr, the mother of Bakr. Abu Bakr was a successful, wealthy merchant, but like Muhammad, he came from a weak clan that had fallen on hard times. Abu Bakr was well-liked and of easy manners, Ibn Ishaq tells us, a kindly, approachable man, especially skilled in the interpretation of dreams. Many of the younger generation, who were disturbed by the aggressive capitalism of Mecca, came to him for advice. Some of the young felt an urgent sense of personal peril, a torpor of depression from which they longed to awake, and a frightening alienation from their parents. The son of an important financier in one of the more powerful clans dreamed that his father was trying to push him into a pit that was filled with fire. Then he had felt two strong hands pulling him to safety and realized at the moment of waking that his saviour was Muhammad. Another youth, this one from the prestigious clan of Abd Shams, came to Abu Bakr after dreaming that he had heard a voice crying aloud in the desert, "Sleepers awake," and proclaiming that a prophet had appeared in Mecca. Both these young men became Muslims, but the first kept his new faith a secret from his father for as long as he could. And the latter's conversion greatly displeased the elders of his clan, who were among the most influential men in Mecca. The revelations had brought to light a fault line in the city. Over the years, a worrying divide had opened between young and old, rich and poor, men and women. This was dangerous. The scripture that was being revealed to Muhammad, verse by verse, surah by surah, condemned this kind of inequality. One faction would inevitably suffer at the hands of another. Any society that was divided against itself would be destroyed because it was going against the very nature of things. This was a frightening period. The incessant wars between Persia and Byzantium seemed to herald the end of the old world order, and even within Arabia, tribal warfare had reached chronic proportions. During the last 20 years, the Ghazu, the acquisition raid, which had traditionally been short and sharp, had escalated into long drawn-out military campaigns as a result of unprecedented drought and famine. There was an apocalyptic sense of impending catastrophe. Muhammad was convinced that unless the Quraysh reformed their attitudes and behaviour, they too would fall prey to the anarchy that threatened to engulf the world.
Under the inspiration of Allah, Muhammad was feeling his way towards an entirely new solution, convinced that he was not speaking in his own name, but was simply repeating the revealed words of God. It was a painful, difficult process. He once said, "Never once did I receive a revelation without thinking that my soul had been torn away from me." Sometimes the message was clear. He could almost see and hear Gabriel distinctly. The words seemed to come down to him like a shower of life-giving rain. But often the divine voice was muffled and obscure. "Sometimes," he says, "it comes unto me like the reverberations of a bell. And that is the hardest upon me. The reverberations abate when I am aware of their message." He had to listen to the undercurrent of events, trying to discover what was really going on. He would grow pale with the effort and cover himself with his cloak as if to shield himself from the divine impact. He would perspire heavily, even on a cold day, as he turned inwards, searching his soul for a solution to a problem, in rather the same way as a poet
has to open himself to the words that he must haul from the depths of himself to the conscious level of his mind. In the Quran, God instructed Muhammad to listen intently to each revelation as it emerged. He must be careful not to impose a meaning on a verse prematurely, before its full significance had become entirely clear. In the Quran, therefore, God spoke directly to the people of Mecca, using Muhammad as his mouthpiece, just as he spoke through the Hebrew prophets in the Jewish scriptures. Hence, the language of the Quran is sacred, because, Muslims believe, it records the words spoken in some way by God himself. When Muhammad's converts listened to the divine voice, chanted first by the prophet and later by the skilled Quran reciters, they felt that they had an immediate encounter with Allah. Biblical Hebrew is experienced as a holy tongue in rather the same way. Christians do not have this concept of a sacred language because there is nothing holy about New Testament Greek. Their scriptures presented Jesus as the word spoken by God to humanity. Like any scripture, the Quran thus provided an encounter with transcendence, bridging the immense gulf between our frail mortal world and the divine. Muhammad's converts eagerly awaited each new revelation. After he had recited it, they would learn it by heart, and those who were literate wrote it down. They felt moved and stirred by the exquisite language of their scripture, which, they were convinced, could only have come from God. It is difficult for a non-Arabic speaker to appreciate the beauty of the Quran because this is rarely conveyed in translation. The text seems wearyingly repetitive. It has no apparent structure, no sustained argument or organizing narrative. But the Quran was not designed to be read sequentially. In its final form, the chapters or surahs of the Quran had been arranged arbitrarily, beginning with the longest and ending with the shortest, so the order is not important. Each surah contains essential teachings, and it is possible to dip into the text at any point and imbibe crucial lessons. In common with the majority of Arabs at this time, Muhammad could neither read nor write. The word Quran means recitation. It was not designed for private perusal, but, like most scriptures, it was meant to be read aloud, and the sound was an essential part of the sense. Poetry was important in Arabia. The poet was the spokesman, social historian, and cultural authority of his tribe. And over the years, the Arabs had learned how to listen to a recitation and had developed a highly sophisticated critical ear. Bards chanted their odes at the annual trade fairs to excited audiences from all over the peninsula. Every year there was an important poetry contest at the fair of Ukaz just outside Mecca, and the winning poems were embroidered in gold on fine black cloth and hung on the walls of the Kaaba. Muhammad's followers would, therefore, have been able to pick up verbal signals in the text that are lost in translation. They found that themes, words, phrases, and sound patterns recurred again and again, like the variations in a piece of music which subtly amplify the original melody and add layer upon layer of complexity. The Quran was deliberately repetitive. Its ideas, images and stories were bound together by these internal echoes, which reinforced its central teaching with instructive shifts of emphasis. They linked passages that initially seemed separate and integrated the different strands of the text as one verse delicately qualified and supplemented others. The Quran was not imparting factual information that could be conveyed instantaneously. Like Muhammad, listeners had to absorb its teachings slowly. Their understanding would grow more profound and mature over time, and the rich, elusive language and rhythms of the Quran helped them to slow down their mental processes and enter a different mode of consciousness.
The American scholar, Michael Sells, describes what happens when the driver of a hot, crowded bus in Egypt plays a cassette of Quranic recitations. A meditative calm begins to set in. People relax. The jockeying for space ends. The voices of those who are talking grow quieter and less strained. Others are silent, lost in thought. A sense of shared community overtakes the discomfort. Breath control is crucial to most of the contemplative traditions. Yogins have found that it brings a feeling of expansiveness comparable to the effect of music, especially when played by oneself. Quranic reciters chant long phrases on a slow exhalation and, when they inhale, leave silent pauses for meditation. It is natural for the audience to adjust their breathing too, and find that this has a calming, therapeutic effect which enables them to grasp the more elusive teachings of the text. God was not booming clear instructions from on high. The divine voice constantly changed the way it referred to itself as we, he, your Lord, Allah, or I, shifting its relationship to both the prophet and his audience. Nor was God distinctively male. Each recitation began with the invocation, "In the name of Allah, the compassionate, Al-Rahman, and the merciful, Al-Rahim." Allah was a masculine noun, but the divine names Al-Rahman and Al-Rahim are not only grammatically feminine, but related etymologically to the word for womb. A partly personified female figure was central to nearly all the early revelations. We find veiled allusions to a woman conceiving a child or giving birth, the image of a woman who has lost her only child, and the poignant evocation of a baby girl murdered by her disappointed parents. This strong female presence was remarkable in the aggressive patriarchy of Mecca, and may explain why women were among the first to respond to the message of the Quran. In each of the early surahs, God spoke intimately to the individual, often preferring to pose many of his teachings in the form of a question. Have you not heard? Do you consider? Have you not seen? Each listener was thus invited to interrogate him or herself. Any response to these queries was usually grammatically ambiguous or indefinite, leaving the audience with an image on which to meditate, but with no decisive answer. This new religion was not about achieving metaphysical certainty. The Quran wanted people to develop a different kind of awareness. The Christian notion of the Last Judgment was central to the early message of the Quran. Muhammad believed that Mecca was in crisis because the Quraysh no longer felt accountable for their actions.
A tribal hero may have been arrogant and egotistic, but he had felt responsible for all the members of his tribe. The Quraysh, however, were busily amassing private fortunes without giving a thought to the plight of the weak. They did not seem to realize that their deeds would have long-lasting consequence. To counter this heedlessness, the Quran taught that individuals would have to explain their behavior to God. There would be a day of reckoning, Yawm ad-Din. The Arabic term also implies a moment of truth. At the end of their lives, human beings would have to face up to uncomfortable realities they had tried to avoid. They would experience a terrifying ontological reversal in which everything that had seemed solid, important, and permanent would prove to be ephemeral. In staccato, lapidary verses, the early chapters tore this veil of delusion away. When the sun is overturned, when the stars fall away, when the mountains are moved, when the 10-month pregnant camels are abandoned, when the beasts of the wild are herded together, when the seas are boiled over, then
a soul will know what it has prepared. Sun, moon, and stars would disappear. Even a pregnant camel, the desert Arab's most precious possession, had no lasting value. All that really mattered was a person's conduct. At that time, people will straggle forth to be shown what they have done. Whoever does a mote's weight good will see it. Whoever does a mote's weight wrong will see it. Deeds that had seemed unimportant at the time would prove to have been momentous. A tiny act of selfishness and unkindness, or, conversely, an unconsidered act of generosity, would become the measure of a human life. To free a slave, to feed the destitute on a day of hunger, a kinsman, orphan, or a stranger out of luck, in need. Anybody who had performed these works of justice, or salihat, would be rewarded eternally in paradise. But those who had concentrated on the selfish acquisition of material possessions would be punished in the Jahim, a strange word, usually translated raging fire. But the Quran was not preaching a crudely apocalyptic vision of hell. The passages describing the Jahim are sad rather than angry. Would elaborate on the themes of heaven, hell, and judgment, but the Quran remains reticent, its language characteristically elusive and mysterious. More crucially, it compels the listener to face up to the judgment in the immediate present. The Day of Reckoning was not merely a distant event, it was also a moment of truth here and now. The probing, intimate questioning and the use of the present tense obliged listeners to face up to the implications of their behaviour on a daily basis. What would it be like to know that you had wasted your time on earth when it was too late to do anything about it? The Quran asks insistently, "Where are you going with your life?" Human beings were not inherently evil, but they were forgetful, all too eager to push these uncomfortable ideas to the back of their minds. So they needed a constant reminder, or zikr. "Remind them," God urged Muhammad. "All you can do is be a reminder." People must therefore become self-aware, conscious of what they are doing. They must cultivate the virtue of taqwa, a word that is sometimes translated fear, but is better rendered mindfulness. They must be continually on their guard against selfishness, greed, and arrogance. Instead of frightening themselves with the fear of hell, they should meditate on the signs, or ayat, of God's generosity in the natural world, and imitate his benevolence. Look at the camel and how it is created. Look at the sky and how it is raised. Look at the mountains and how they are set. Look at the earth and how it is spread. The entire cosmos was a veil which hid the presence of its creator. The succession of day and night, sun and moon, the life-giving rains and the marvellous construction of the human being were all signs of God's presence. By contemplating these signs in a sustained and disciplined manner, they would become aware of the inexpressible reality behind them and be filled with gratitude. At present, the Quraysh despised the weak. They believed that failure and poverty revealed an inherent lack of nobility, so they felt no obligation towards the poor, the orphan, or the widow. But if they understood their dependence upon Allah at every moment of their lives, they would appreciate their own frailty, and their arrogance would be tempered by awe and wonder. They would lay aside their haughty self-reliance and their proudly cultivated refusal to bow to any creature,
human or divine. Muhammad wanted every man, woman, and child in Mecca to develop within themselves the humble thankfulness that should characterize the human condition. Muhammad was not content simply to work for social reform. He believed that without an interior transformation, a purely political program would be superficial. To effect this, he taught his little group the ritual actions that would enable them to cultivate this new attitude. First, they would meet for prayer or salat. Their devout prostration would be a daily reminder of their true condition. Salat interrupted their ordinary business and helped them to remember that Allah was their first priority. It was very difficult for men and women schooled in the old tribal ethos to grovel like slaves, and many of the Quraysh were offended by this abject posture. But the physical routine of Salat symbolized the Islam, the surrender of their entire being to Allah. It taught their bodies, at a level deeper than the rational, to lay aside the self-regarding impulse to prance and preen arrogantly. A Muslim was a man or a woman who had made this act of submission and was proud to be God's slave. Second, members of the Muslim community, the Ummah, were required to give a proportion of their income in alms to the poor. This pure offering, or zakat, took the egotism out of the traditional Bedouin generosity. Instead of exhibiting their reckless, excessive liberality, they made a regular, undramatic contribution to the weaker members of the tribe. The new hero was no longer a person who gave away his entire fortune in a single night, but one who tirelessly practiced the works of justice. At this stage, the new faith was called tazaka, purification. By looking after the poor and needy, freeing slaves, performing small acts of kindness on a daily, hourly basis, the Muslims learned to cloak themselves in the virtue of compassion, and would gradually acquire a responsible, caring spirit which imitated the generosity of Allah Himself. If they persevered, they would purge their hearts of pride and selfishness and achieve a spiritual refinement.
For 3 years, Muhammad kept a low profile, preaching only to carefully selected people. But, somewhat to his dismay, in 615, Allah instructed him to deliver his message to the whole clan of Hashim. "The task is beyond my strength," he told Ali. But he went ahead and invited 40 elders to a frugal meal. The meagre fare was a message in itself. There was to be no more excessive hospitality. Luxury was not simply a waste of money, but ingratitude, a thankless squandering of Allah's precious bounty. When the elders arrived, they were nonplussed when Ali served them a simple leg of mutton and a cup of milk. When he told the story later, Ali made it sound like Jesus' miracle of the loaves and fishes. Even though there was scarcely enough for one person, everybody ate his fill. After the meal, Muhammad rose to address the gathering, told them about his revelations, and started to expound the principles of his religion of Islam. But Abu Lahab, Abu Talib's half-brother, rudely interrupted him. "He's put a spell on you," he cried, and the meeting broke up in disorder. Muhammad had to invite them back the following day, and this time he managed to finish his presentation. "O sons of Abd al-Muttalib," he ended, "I know of no Arab who has come to his people with a nobler message than mine. God has ordered me to call you to him. So which of you will cooperate with me in this venture as my brother, my executor, and my successor?" There was an awkward silence, and the elders looked at one another in embarrassment. They could all remember Muhammad as a little boy living on the charity of his relatives. How dared he claim to be the prophet of Allah?
Even Muhammad's cousin Ja'far and his adopted son Zayd were reluctant to speak. But finally Ali, a gawky 13-year-old, could bear it no longer. "O Prophet of God," he cried, "I will be your helper in this matter." Muhammad laid his hand tenderly on the boy's neck. "This is my brother, my executor, and my successor among you," he said. "Hearken to him and obey him." This was too much. The spell was broken, and the elders burst out laughing. "He's ordered you to listen to your son and obey him," they cried derisively to Abu Talib as they stormed out of the house. Undeterred by this humiliating failure, Muhammad continued to preach more widely in the city, but with very little success. Nobody criticized his social message. They knew that the tribal ethos required them to share their wealth with the poorer members of the tribe. It was one thing to be selfish and greedy, but quite another to defend these attitudes. Most people objected to the day of reckoning. This, they argued, was simply an old wives' tale. How could bodies that had rotted away in the earth come to life again? Was Muhammad seriously suggesting that their venerable ancestors would rise from their graves to stand before the Lord of all beings? The Quran replied that nobody could prove that there was no life after death, and that if Allah could create a human being out of a tiny drop of semen, he could easily resurrect a dead body. It also pointed out that the people who poured scorn on the idea of a final reckoning were precisely those who had no intention of changing their oppressive, selfish behaviour. When faced with the insistent questioning of the Quran about the ultimate value of their life, they took refuge in denial and levity. But despite their scepticism, most of the Quraysh were content to leave Muhammad alone. They were businessmen who had little taste for ideological debate, and they knew that a serious internal conflict would be bad for trade. In any case, this little band of slaves, angry young men, and failing merchants was no real threat, and their movement would surely peter out.
Muhammad himself was anxious to avoid an open rift.
He had no desire to damage Mecca, the mother of cities. He knew that some of the Quraysh thought that he wanted to become king, an abhorrent idea to the Arabs, who were deeply suspicious of monarchy. But Muhammad had no political ambitions. As if to reassure his critics, God told him firmly that he must not aspire to public office. He was simply a nadir, a messenger with a warning, and should approach the Quraysh humbly, avoid provocation, and be careful not to attack their gods. This is what the great prophets had done in the past. A prophet had to be altruistic. He must not trumpet his own opinions egotistically or trample on the sensibilities of others, but should always put the welfare of the community first. A prophet was first and foremost a Muslim, one of those who have surrendered themselves unto Allah. In his desire to avoid a serious dispute, Muhammad did not, at this stage, emphasize the monotheistic content of his message. Like the Hanifs, he was convinced that Allah was the only God, but he did not at first condemn the worship of the stone idols around the Kaaba or the cult of the three goddesses, the Garanik. Like most of the great religious sages, he was not much interested in orthodoxy. Metaphysical speculation tended to make people quarrelsome and could be divisive. It was more important to practice the works of justice than to insist on a theological position that would offend many of the people he was trying to win over. But tension was growing. In 616, some of the Quraysh attacked the Muslims while they were performing their ritual prayers in one of the glens outside the city. The incident shocked everybody in Mecca, and both sides desperately tried to reach a modus vivendi. This may have led to the notorious incident of the so-called Satanic Verses.
The episode is recounted by only two of Muhammad's early biographers, and some scholars believe it to be apocryphal, though it is hard to see why anybody would make it up. Both historians emphasized the desire for reconciliation in the city at this time. Ibn Sa'd starts his account by saying that in his desire to avoid an irrevocable breach with the Quraysh, Muhammad sat down by himself, wishing that nothing be revealed to him that would drive them away. The historian Tabari, however, begins, "When the apostle saw that his people had turned their backs on him, and he was pained by their estrangement from what he had brought them from God, he longed that there should come to him, from God, a message that would reconcile his people to him. Because of his love for his people and his anxiety over them, it would delight him that the obstacle that made his task so difficult could be removed. So he meditated on the project and longed for it, and it was dear to him." One day, Tabari continues, Muhammad was sitting beside the Kaaba with some of the elders, reciting a new surah, in which Allah tried
Muhammad
to reassure
his critics.
Intended to cause all this trouble, the divine voice insisted. He was not deluded nor inspired by a jinni. He had experienced a true vision of the divine and was simply telling his people what he had seen and heard. But then, to his surprise, Muhammad found himself chanting some verses about the three goddesses, the daughters of God. "Have you then ever considered what you are worshipping in Alat and Al-Uzza, as well as Manat, the third, the other?" Immediately, the Quraysh sat up and listened intently. They loved the goddesses who mediated with Allah on their behalf. "These are the exalted cranes, the Garanik," Muhammad continued, "whose intercession is approved." Tabari claims that these words were put on his lips by the Shaitan, the tempter. This is a very alarming notion to Christians, who regard Satan as a figure of monstrous evil. The Quran is certainly familiar with the story of the fallen angel who defied God. It calls him Iblis, a contraction of the Greek diabolos, devil. But the Shaitan who inspired this gracious compliment to the goddesses was a far less threatening creature. Shaitans were simply a species of jinn. They were tempters who suggested the empty, facile, and self-indulgent yearnings that deflected humans from the right path. Like all jinn, the Shaitans were ubiquitous, mischievous, and dangerous, but not on a par with the devil. Muhammad had been longing for peace with the Quraysh. He knew how devoted they were to the goddesses, and may have thought that if he could find a way of incorporating the Garanik, the goddesses, into his religion, they might look more kindly on his message. When he recited the rogue verses, it was his own desire talking, not Allah, and the endorsement of the goddesses proved to be a mistake. Like any other Arab, he naturally attributed his error to a shaitan.
Muhammad not implied that the three daughters of God were on the same level as Allah.
They were simply intermediaries, like the angels whose intercession is approved in the same surah. Jews and Christians have always found such mediators compatible with their monotheism. The new verses seemed a truly propitious gesture, and their effect on the Quraysh was electrifying. As soon as Muhammad had finished his recitation, he prostrated himself in prayer. And, to his astonishment, the Quraishian elders knelt down beside him, humbly pressing their foreheads to the ground. The news spread like wildfire through the city. "Muhammad has spoken of our gods in splendid fashion. He alleged in what he recited that they are the exalted Garanik, the heavenly birds whose intercession is approved." The crisis was over. The elders told Muhammad, "We know that Allah kills and gives life, creates and preserves. But these, our goddesses, pray to him for us.
and since you have now permitted them to share divine honours with Allah, we therefore desire to unite with you." But Muhammad was troubled. This was too easy. Were the Quraysh really going to amend their behaviour, share their wealth with the poor, and be content to become the humble slaves of God? It did not seem likely. He was also disturbed by the jubilant words of the elders. He had certainly not meant to imply that the goddesses shared divine honours with Allah. While everybody else was celebrating, Muhammad went home, shut himself away, and meditated.
That night, Gabriel, the spirit of revelation, came to him. "What have you done, Muhammad?" he asked. "You have recited to those people something I did not bring you from God, and have said what he did not say to you." Muhammad's wish for a compromise had distorted the divine message. He was immediately contrite, but God consoled him with a new revelation. All the previous prophets had made similar satanic mistakes. It was always a struggle to make sense of the revelations, and all too easy to confuse the deeper current of inspiration with a more superficial idea of one's own. But, the revelation continued, God renders null and void whatever aspersion the shaitan might cast, and God makes his messages clear in and by themselves. An important principle had been established. God could alter his scriptures at the time that they were being revealed to a particular prophet. Revelation was progressive. We might say that Muhammad sometimes saw fresh implications in his message that qualified some of his earlier insights. Now Muhammad had to go back to the Quraysh with a new verse that amended the satanic ones. Once again God asked, "Have you then ever considered what you are worshipping in Alat and Al-Uzza, as well as in Manat?" But this time his answer was scathing. Why did they attribute daughters to Allah when they themselves preferred sons? These so-called goddesses were simply empty names, human projections fabricated by the Quraysh and their forefathers. Those who worship them follow nothing but surmise and their own wishful thinking. This was a slap in the face that not only eliminated the goddesses, but insulted the revered ancestors. Why did the Quran find it impossible to accommodate these three goddesses alongside the angels? Why ruin the chance of peace with this uncompromising rejection of an apparently harmless devotion?
After 4 years of Islam, Muslims could no longer take the traditional religion seriously. For most of the Quraysh, Allah was still a remote high god who did not impinge on their daily lives. But this was no longer true for Muhammad's converts. The beauty of the Quran had made Allah a vibrant, indeed overwhelming reality. The Quran says that when they listen to their scripture, a chill creeps over the skins of those who fear their Lord, and after a while their skins and hearts soften at the remembrance of God. The word of God was experienced as a powerful reality that could shatter the world. "Had we bestowed this Quran from on high upon a mountain," God told Muhammad, "thou would see it humbling itself, breaking asunder for awe of God." Allah was now completely different from the deity worshipped by the Quraysh, and the so-called satanic verses were wrong to suggest that Islam was the same as the old religion. It was ludicrous to imagine that the three stone idols of the goddesses could influence the God of Islam. The Quran now began to make this distinction clear. The other deities were as helpless and ineffective as dangerously weak tribal chiefs. They could not provide food for their worshippers, as Allah did, and they would not be able to intercede on behalf of their devotees on the day of reckoning. Nothing was on a par with Allah.
Shortly after the repudiation of the satanic verses, the Surah of Sincerity was revealed. Say, He is God, one God, forever, not begetting, unbegotten, and having as equal none. The principle of Tawhid, unity, became the crux of Muslim spirituality. It was not simply an abstract metaphysical affirmation of the singularity of the divine, but, like all Quranic teaching, a call to action. Because Allah was incomparable, Muslims must not only refuse to venerate the idols, but must also ensure that other realities did not distract them from their commitment to God alone. Wealth, country, family, material prosperity, and even such noble ideals as love or patriotism must take second place. Tawhid demanded that Muslims integrate their lives. In the struggle to make God their sole priority, a Muslim would glimpse in the properly ordered self the unity that was God. It was perhaps at this time that new converts were first required to utter the Shahada, the declaration of faith recited by all Muslims today. I bear witness that there is no God but Allah, and that Muhammad is his prophet. The Quraysh would not have been shocked by monotheism per se, which was not, after all, a new idea to them. They had long found the religion of Jews and Christians compatible with their own traditions and had not been particularly disturbed by the Hanif's attempt to create an authentically Arabian monotheism. But Muhammad was doing something different. Most Hanifs had retained a deep respect for the Haram and had made no attempt to reform the social order. But in attacking the effigies that surrounded the Kaaba, Muhammad implied that the Haram, on which the Meccan economy depended, was worthless. The Bedouin tribes did not make the Hajj to visit the house of Allah, but to pay their respects to their own tribal gods, whose cult was now condemned by the Quran in the strongest terms. Quraysh often invoked the three goddesses as they circumambulated the Kaaba. Now this practice was dismissed as deluded and self-indulgent. Ta'if, where Alat had her shrine, provided Mecca with its food. Many of the Quraysh had summer homes in this fertile oasis. How could Ta'if remain on friendly terms with them if they condoned the insult to their goddess? Overnight, Muhammad had become the enemy. The Quraysh leaders sent a delegation to Abu Talib, asking him to disown his nephew. Nobody could survive in Arabia without an official protector. A man who had been expelled from his clan could be killed with impunity without fear of vendetta. Abu Talib, who was genuinely fond of Muhammad and not himself a Muslim, was in an impossible position. He tried to temporize, but the Quraysh returned with an ultimatum. By God, we cannot endure that our fathers should be reviled, our customs mocked, and our gods insulted, they cried. Until you rid us of him, we will fight the pair of you until one side perishes. Abu Talib summoned Muhammad, begging him to stop this subversive preaching. Spare me and yourself, he pleaded. Do not put upon me a burden greater than I can bear. Convinced that Abu Talib was about to abandon him, Muhammad replied with tears in his eyes, O my uncle, by God, if they put the sun in my right hand and the moon in my left on condition that I abandon this course until God has made it victorious or I perish therein, I would not abandon it. He then broke down and left the room, weeping bitterly. His uncle called him back. Go and say what you please, for by God I will never give you up on any account. For a while, Muhammad was safe. As long as Abu Talib remained his patron and could make this protection effective, nobody dared touch him. Abu Talib was a gifted poet, and he now wrote passionate verses denouncing the clans who had deserted Hashim in its hour of need. The clan of Al-Mutalib responded by declaring their solidarity with Hashim. But this good news was followed by a fateful defection. Abu Lahab, Abu Talib's half-brother, had opposed Muhammad and his revelations from the start. But to prevent a schism within the clan, he had betrothed two of his sons to Muhammad's daughters, Ruqayya and Kulthum. Now he forced his sons to repudiate the women. The elegant young Muslim aristocrat Uthman ibn Affan, however, had long admired Ruqayya, one of the most beautiful girls in Mecca, and could now ask Muhammad for her hand.
The Quraysh elders, especially those who had lost family members to Islam, now mounted a furious offensive against Muhammad. They would ostentatiously turn their backs whenever they heard Muslims praising Allah as the one and only divine being, and aggressively demonstrate their joy when the other deities were invoked. They demanded that everybody remain faithful to the traditional faith. It was the only decent thing to do. All this talk of revelation was outrageous. Muhammad had made the whole thing up. Why should he alone of all the Quraysh have received a divine message? Muhammad was mad. He had been led astray by a jinni. He was a sorcerer who lured young people away from their father's sunnah, their way of life, by magic arts. When he was asked to validate his claims by working a miracle, as Moses or Jesus had done, he admitted that he was an ordinary mortal like themselves. The leaders of the opposition included some of the most powerful clan chiefs in Mecca. Foremost among them were Abu al-Hakam, an irascible, ambitious man who seemed deeply disturbed by Islam. The elderly, corpulent Umayyah ibn Khalaf and the highly intelligent Abu Sufyan, who had been a personal friend of Muhammad, together with his father-in-law, Utbah ibn Rabia, and his brother. As yet, Suhail ibn Amr, chief of Amir, a devout man who, like Muhammad, had made an annual retreat on Mount Hira, had not yet made up his mind, and Muhammad hoped to win him over. Some of the most able young men in Mecca were also virulently hostile to Islam. The warriors Amr ibn al-As and Khalid ibn al-Walid, and, most zealous of all, Umar ibn al-Khattab, the nephew of Abu al-Hakam, who was fanatically devoted to the old religion. While the other chiefs were proceeding cautiously against Muhammad, Umar was ready for more extreme methods. Muhammad had now given up hope of converting the Meccan establishment and realized that he must concentrate on the disaffected poorer people who were eager for his message. This was an important turning point, which is recorded poignantly in the Quran. Muhammad had been so absorbed in a discussion with some of the Meccan grandees that he impatiently frowned and turned away when a blind man approached him with a question. God reproved Muhammad severely. A prophet must approach all members of the community with the same respect. He must move beyond the aristocratic ethos of Muruwa. The Quran was for rich and poor alike. In brushing the blind man aside as though he did not matter, Muhammad had behaved like a kafir. The word kafir is often translated unbeliever, but this is extremely misleading. Muhammad had no quarrel with the beliefs of Abu al-Hakam and Abu Sufyan. In fact, much of their theology was quite correct. They believed without question, for example, that Allah was the creator of the world and the Lord of the Kaaba. The trouble was that they did not translate their beliefs into action. They were impervious to the true meaning of the signs of God's benevolence in his creation, which required human beings to imitate him in all their dealings. Instead of despising and oppressing vulnerable people, they should behave like Allah and spread over them the wings of tenderness.
Fear derives from a root word meaning ingratitude.
It implies a discourteous refusal of something that is offered with great kindness and generosity. When God had revealed himself to the people of Mecca, some of them had, as it were, spat contemptuously in his face. The Quran does not berate the kafirun for their lack of religious conviction, but for their arrogance. They are haughty and supercilious. They imagine that they are superior to the poorer, humbler people of Mecca, whom they consider second-class citizens and therefore worthy of contempt. Instead of realizing their utter dependence upon God, they still regard themselves as self-reliant and refuse to bow to Allah or anybody else. The kafirun are bursting with self-importance. They strut around haughtily, addressing others in an offensive, braying manner, and fly into a violent rage if they think that their honour has been impugned. They are so convinced that their way of life is better than anybody else's that they are particularly incensed by any criticism of their traditional lifestyle. They sneer at Allah's revelation, perversely distorting the sense of the Quran simply to display their cleverness. They were unable even to consider anything new. Their hearts were veiled, rusted over, sealed, and locked.
This ends Disc 2.